good afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. You are listening to this, if you're listening to it live, it is Sunday, April 12th, 2020. It is Easter, and we're all uncharacteristically having Easter in our house or while walking our dog, which is strange but true. So, in the strange but true, who's our sponsor?
Our sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Were you almost stumped?
No, I was thinking, you know, it's starting to warm up outside and it won't be long before the grass all turns brown and
things start. You can't mow it.
Yeah, you can't mow it and then it'll catch on fire and then PG&E will shut your power off and then you're going to need a generator and then you're going to need to call Pape Machinery and get yourself a brand new Honda generator so you're not sitting in the dark.
Oh, yes, there's that.
And losing all your food in your freezer and all that good stuff. So give them a call over there. They got lots in stock and they can get you fixed up.
There you go.
There you are.
So we are here with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who is a super interesting guy and talks all about the EMP Commission. He's, let me just spin through the top half of it. Executive Director on the Task Force on National Homeland Security and the Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategic Forum, both congressional advisory boards, and serves on the EMP Commission, Congressional EMP Commission. There is a link that we have added in this last hour at his behest. It is the Task Force. The Task Force on EMP, and it's emptaskforce.us. And we've put that on the page in two different places, so don't tell me you can't find it. We've also listed his books that are super interesting. The newest is The Power and the Light, the EMP Commission's War to Save America from 2001 to 2020. So it isn't like, you know, it was one meeting went haywire and he wrote a book about it. Blackout Wars is another one. The EMP Manhattan Project. Civil Military Preparedness for an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe. That sounded interesting. War Scare, Russia and America on the Nuclear Brink, because he does tons of stuff with Russia. Not like Russia, 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 the hoax, but Russia, the actual place and the actual issues. And then here's another one back from 2018, Poseidon, Russia's New Doomsday Machine. So I think that he could keep you entertained for a really long time. I know we've had him on. I've got some other shows listed on the page for today, so you can go back and listen. The one I think we replayed recently was Time for a Full-Scale Purge of the Intelligence Community, and we're kind of veering back into that lane as this program goes on. So, Dr. Pry, where would you like to take us now, since our five-second break is over?
Okay, well, let me talk about some things that haven't been reported, recent events that people haven't heard about, because it's all been about the coronavirus, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But that the American people should know about. This April, Russia is going to deploy the first of 8 Bori-class ballistic missile submarines. This is a new ballistic missile submarine, all right, that Putin threatened he was going to deploy 2 years ago. And when the fleet is deployed, the first of 8 is going in. When all 8 of those are deployed, with those submarines alone, they will have enough warheads of sufficient accuracy to win a nuclear war against the United States, just with the Bori SSBN fleet, which is their new advanced ballistic missile submarine. Guess when we are going to deploy our next new ballistic missile submarine?
Never.
2035.
Oh, I was going to say 10 years from now. That was close.
Wow. The Columbus class. Our first Columbus-class ballistic missile submarine will go into the water.
That's one.
You see, this business about U.S. incompetence, okay, the corruption and incompetence of the system, you know, is evident not just in the coronavirus, not just in EMP. It's a virus that affects the whole federal bureaucracy, including the Department of Defense, which used to be, still is really the best part of the U.S. government. But even it, and it's not the fault chiefly of the Department of Defense. They have to follow orders from Congress and the President. But we've had so many bad Congresses and so many bad Presidents, 8 years of Obama. This is what it's done to us in terms of the nuclear balance. And that's just one part of it. Here's another thing. Putin announced that that they're going to start the assembly lines for their new super ICBM, Satan 2, the Satan 2 ICBM.
It's a great name for an ICBM.
Right. And it is also an ICBM. It's basically, we have nothing like it. You know, it has an unlimited range. It could deliver weapons against us over the South Pole. We have no ballistic missile early warning radars or interceptors facing south to intercept something like that. Our interceptors aren't designed for intercepting these systems, and it could carry up to 40 hypersonic warheads. You know, this ICBM alone, don't count the submarines, just this ICBM. When they're done fielding this ICBM, they could win a nuclear war just with this ICBM. Guess when our new ICBM is scheduled to be deployed?
20 years from now.
20 years from now. That's right.
It won't be the end.
It won't until built to the end of the 2030s, around 2038, 2039, that we'll be replacing the venerable Minuteman missiles, which were deployed in the 1960s.
Hmm.
You know, this is just another fact that Americans might be interested in.
Why does it take so long?
It takes foot dragging to a new low
to deploy something like that or to develop something like that.
Well, that's a complicated answer. But can I give you one more fact?
Mm-hmm,
all right,
please.
And then I'll answer that question, because I'm afraid I'm going to go on and not get in this last kind of the punchline to these two facts. All right. Also, what just happened 2 weeks ago that people, I'm sure, haven't heard about is that North Macedonia is now the 30th member of NATO. North Macedonia has become a NATO member state, which means you, the American people, are on the hook to defend mm-hmm. North Macedonia against all comers, including in a nuclear war.
Great.
So, and by the way, it's also just an interesting bit of trivia about why they're called North Macedonia now. The Macedonia, they were originally called Macedonia up until a few weeks ago. But Greece wouldn't let them in the NATO alliance as long as they had that name. And one of the reasons for that is 25 centuries ago, during the Peloponnesian Wars, Macedonia was allied with Sparta against Athens.
When we wore sandals to war.
These are our allies, my friends, okay?
Wow.
You know, this is what we've gotten ourselves into in NATO.
Wow.
And so the Macedonians kind of tricked the Greeks, and they did change their name to North Macedonia, all right? But the Greeks are still upset at that because they've still got Macedonia.
That's a grudge taken to a new height, actually.
Exactly. But in that part of the world, they're famous for holding grudges. And we're responsible for their defense, including with nuclear weapons. And we don't. And we are falling further and further behind. And why is it? Why is it? Well, nuclear weapons are particularly politically incorrect. It was very hard during the Cold War. I mean, the country, compared to the way we are today, was united. You know. For all the divisions, I mean, people who lived through the Cold War during the Reagan years and all the rest, you know that there were deep divisions and there were harsh arguments and Republicans and Democrats. It was hard to imagine America more deeply divided if you were living in those times. But if we could have turned the clock forward to the times in which we now live, you know, in retrospect, you know, like the Carter and the Reagan years look like some kind of golden age of American consensus and unity, and we were able to have a united front against comers like the Soviet Union, enemies like the Soviet Union, and we were able to sustain a consensus through the Cold War to follow certain basic rules of survival, like, you know, maintaining a modern nuclear arsenal, making sure that we were second to none in terms of the number of our nuclear weapons, the modernity of our nuclear weapons, the advanced technology of our nuclear weapons. And then the Cold War ended, and that consensus fell apart, and the Democrat Party drifted further to the left. And we got President Bush, who, the first President Bush, you know, who thought, well, the Cold War is over. It's the end of history. The forces of freedom have won. Even Russia agrees with that. And in the future, you know, Russia can be brought into the community of nations and become maybe a democracy eventually. And so as a grand gesture to the Cold War is over, we're going to dismantle U.S. tactical nuclear weapons. And we had the PNI, the Presidential Nuclear Initiative, signed by then-President Boris Yeltsin, President of Russia then, and our George Bush, where the sides agreed to dismantle their tactical nuclear weapons. And we did, all of them except about 180 that are still they're obsolete and bunkered in Western Europe.
Because globalism
the
was...
staff cheated, and they didn't dismantle their tactical nuclear weapons.
No.
Not only that, they continued
I'm
to
shocked.
Modernize them. So they we obeyed the arms control treaties. They cheat on them. That's part of a short answer to it.
All right. Take a quick breath. Oh, no, don't. Ashley said we have a break, but we don't. She's lying. She's waving her hands. We'll just keep talking. Okay, we'll keep going
okay,
then. Sorry.
As we have a series of radicalized presidents who were not your FDR, JFK-type Democrats. Bill Clinton was not out of the tradition of FDR and JFK. He came out of the tradition of the anti-war, blame America first crowd, the radicalized 60s generation. And President Obama was even worse. And these guys are anti-nuclear in their bones. And they basically stopped nuclear testing. They stopped the modernization. There was even a law that was in effect for 10 years that prohibited, called the Sprint First Amendment, the National Defense Authorization Act, that made it illegal for our scientists at nuclear weapons laboratories to work or even think about new generation nuclear weapons.
Oh, no wonder we got behind.
All these restrictions, and the Russians, everybody else, cheated on them and went forward. So we're 25 years behind. That's what happens when you basically paralyze yourself and do nothing for 25 years and ignore what the other guys are doing. And now we are in this situation where Russia this month is going to be deploying new ballistic missile submarines, and we are going to have to take 15 years to get our first. You know, we're so far behind, I'm afraid we'll never be able to catch up.
I think we need to rename the show, The War on Preparedness.
Right.
Because it seems like at every corner, you know, hey, we could have been prepared, but we decided not to. And we could have worked on that while we had all the time and the people to do it, but we decided not to.
Well, the only
hypersonic weapons, they beat us to hypersonic weapons. It's an example of a new technology that they've got that we don't have, super EMP weapons. Even North Korea's got super EMP weapons. We don't have them. The Russians have got a whole new generation of nuclear weapons that are specialized for X radiation and neutrons, clean battlefield weapons that make no fallout, so they're very usable. We don't have anything like that in our tactical nuclear inventory.
Great.
And we're going to be very surprised if we end up getting in a fight with Russia or China, because they're not open the way we are. You know, this is just the stuff we know about. You know, we don't know about the things they've kept secret from us, and they're very good at keeping secrets, unlike us.
Well, yeah, but they're not nearly as prepared for climate change as we are. So,
yeah, that's right. We're going to be far more prepared for climate.
That's right.
Yeah, because one thing that's happened with everybody being stuck inside during the virus is people have become, you know, pretty funny. Actually, I think it's just the nature of the beast, but there was a meme that came out and it said, you know, can I pay a tax to get rid of the virus because it works for climate change?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we could just have a tax for the virus. It'll be gone, and have another tax for preparedness, and maybe it'll fix that, because climate change can't be the only thing that, you know, is cured by a tax. Ashley, are we taking a break? Okay. I figured either that or we'd have to take them all at one time. So we'll be back in just 2 minutes. A little shout out to capitalism. And our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Pride.
Yes, it would be time to get back to that. When we did really pay attention to all that. What do you think in 4 more years of President Trump, do you think we'll be able to, you know, kind of swerve some of these back into the correct lane?
I really hope so. But I have to say my confidence is shaken, by the way he's managing the coronavirus. And I know I'm not going to be a popular fellow for saying this because I'm not even popular in my own family when I say this. It's politically incorrect, and I get attacked for saying anything negative about President Trump. But I think, you know, one can't have... One has to always look at the facts, even when the guy is on your side and you support him and all the rest. I think he has really... as I said, I explained it sort of at length in the beginning of this broadcast about how the CDC and the NIH shouldn't have been trusted in the first place. You know, I wish he had gone to independent experts. There were independent voices out there in academia. There were some on his, President Trump, for example, correctly believes climate change is a hoax. And for a while, he had a gentleman, a scientist named Will Happer, on his National Security Council staff, who was advising him on the fact that climate change is a big hoax. And, unfortunately, President Trump doesn't seem to be very good at protecting his allies and people who believe in him and his vision. And he allows the bureaucracy, comprised mostly of people hostile to him, to drive his closest allies out of government. Happer, for example, isn't on the NSC staff anymore. Nor, as you know, is K.T. McFarland and a number of other conservative advisors who came into him. You know, they've been picked off by the bureaucracy. And so, you know, he's been 3 years in government, and still, I don't think he fully grasps how to govern, because he trusted the deep state. You know, for reasons we discussed earlier. You know, the Center for Disease Control and the National Institute for Health—they're part of the deep state, and these are the people that caused the problem. The people who are speaking on television with him today—they're responsible for the fact that we don't have the masks, we don't have the ventilators. They handed this turd, if I can use that word, okay, to the president. And instead of firing them and hiring and going turning to good people, or at least ignoring them and bringing in other people, you know, there are conservative scientists he could turn to who would have had a better idea. And instead he's followed their advice. And now, you know, millions of Americans are out of work and the economy is shut down. And I think that was unnecessary.
I always wonder if... because he comes from the business world, he thought that these people were professionals.
Exactly.
And that they would do their job because
exactly.
In the business world, even if you had a new CEO, you don't fire everybody who used to work at the company. I mean, you might replace some people, but bottom line is most of the people are there to do their job, and you get a new CEO and they still do their job. I don't think he realized.
Well, and I think, too, he might be getting a little gun-shy. I mean, he has let a few go, and he's just ravaged in the press for it. And
yeah, well.
But he's always ravaged in the press.
Yeah, it's going to happen anyway.
People love
like, it doesn't
it.
Matter.
People, his base loves him for it, what, you know? But, I think he made an enormous mistake when he first came in to office, because routinely... you know, about 4,000 of the top executives mm-hmm. of government routinely return in their resignations. And those are routinely accepted. Except for Trump and Bush. Trump and Bush didn't do that. They both had this naive idea that, you know, oh, we're going to have a bipartisan government. And this was going to be an olive branch. And, you know, Bush was undermined all through his two administrations by the Democrats that he kept in, especially in the Department of Justice, by the way. I mean, do you know, I think it was something like 26 Republican members of Congress were found guilty of alleged corruption of various kinds and driven out of office during the Bush years, you know, as basically a Democrat Justice Department. And only one or two Democrats. I mean, it's amazing. So was the Democrat Party that much cleaner than Republicans? Obviously not. You know, it was obviously, even back in the Bush years, a politicized Department of Justice. And that's one of the things you get future Republican presidents when you fail to accept those resignations. You know, you make the government more and more partisan when you fail to bring in new blood, okay? You know, that process is set up to move the pendulum back to the center. And when you try to be Mr. Nice Guy, you know, it ends up moving it further and further to the left if you're a Republican and you don't accept the resignations. And that's what President Trump did. He had that opportunity. It was a golden missed opportunity because the people who supported him were exactly the kind of people we needed in those positions in Washington. They were the anti-establishment people. You know, we didn't need, you know, more Obama holdovers, and we didn't need more establishment Republicans who are very similar to Obama holdovers in their views.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, is why we've got one of the reasons why the nuclear balance is continuing to be so much against us. I mean, this modernization program we have, it's not President Trump's nuclear weapons modernization program. He's paying for it, but it's the modernization program that Obama promised the Department of Defense if the Senate would sign up to the New START treaty, and it was a very modest, okay, modernization program to begin with, and Obama broke his word. So he got the New START treaty and didn't modernize U.S. nuclear forces. You know, this much ballyhooed modernization of our nuclear deterrent that we're getting is really Obama's plan that has been foisted on Trump. And Trump, he has such good instincts. He was alarmed by this, but when I remember, one of the leaks that came out was Trump, during a National Security Council meeting, wanted to know, hey, how come we've allowed Russia to get all this big advantage in tactical nuclear weapons? How come we don't have more tactical nuclear weapons than them? Wouldn't that make us safer? And he got savaged for that, because according to the establishment Republican and the Democrat view of the strategic balance, mutual assured destruction is God. And the idea of a U.S. advantage is anathema because it violates the tenets of mutual assured destruction. But these guys don't get upset when Russia has decisive advantages in the nuclear balance.
Which is crazy. They're all worried that they're messing with our elections, but which obviously they weren't, but they could blow up our country, and that's no big deal.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, these are extraordinary, perilous times. Someone asked me, I've been asked by people, you know, about whether China is going to go to war against us. And that sounds like an extraordinary thing. It sounds like an alarmist thing to say that we could have a war with China or Russia or Iran or North Korea. But in these highly unstable times, when the United States has so weakened itself, and now we've got the coronavirus shutting down the economy, you know, so that we're in an unprecedented posture of vulnerability, these things sound outlandish until they happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they happen, everybody saw it coming, like the 9/11 attacks, you know, that took the whole system by surprise. Same. We're always getting surprised. Pearl Harbor, you know, the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War, you know, ISIS, the rise of ISIS, you know, surprise. In the past, you know, we've always gotten knocked to the floor by a surprise attack, but fortunately we've been strong enough in the past to be able to dust ourselves off and go on to win. But I don't know if that is, I do know it won't be possible to do it. Not in the age of EMP attack and advanced nuclear weapons and the kinds of weapons and plans that our adversaries have. If we get taken by surprise again, there's not going to be any coming back from it. You know, we can't afford to get taken by surprise again.
Well, had our economy not been as strong as it was when this coronavirus hit, we would have really got knocked in the dirt by it. But thank goodness we were fairly strong at the time, and we didn't get completely dismantled by it. But not to say that it was handled correctly, but
Well, I'm concerned about the constitutional threats too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, as a, and this is where I get a lot of the flack from friends and family and all the rest. But let's suppose that a Democrat president was doing what's happening under the Trump administration.
People would be freaking out.
Exactly. Exactly. It isn't any. It isn't right for this to be happening under President Trump's administration either.
Right. You if know, it happens, well, if it happens with one, it could happen with another.
You know people being fined for going to church, arrested for playing ball with your daughter. You know.
Yeah.
They've shut down national parks here in Virginia. Anyway, they have the Shenandoah. Why is that? You know, to basically do everything they can. People. There was many cases. You know, you can see in the newspapers people being fined for being out of their homes. You know, police interrogating you about what essential mission are you performing by being out of your home?
Well, there were two counties here in California that were worried that they, since everybody had all this time on their hands, they would come swarming into their county to go fishing because they've got, I guess they have really good fishing in those areas. So they requested from the Fish and Game Commission to ban fishing in their counties. Well, that went like wildfire, and then all of a sudden everybody heard they were going to ban fishing in California, and so they had a Fish and Game Commission meeting, and their phone line lit on fire.
Yeah, don't you can keep them from going to church, but boy, you ban them from going fishing,
you are messing with fire. Man, it's all over.
Yeah that's just it's
sure
ridiculous.
Courts and having to go to court and pay the fines for traffic violations and the rest, that all of that is considered an essential service. But dentists are shut down, you know, so you, at least here in Virginia, you can't go to the dentist. But the point is, the larger point I'm making is that there are serious breaches of the Constitution happening. I mean, the government has never been so bold and aggressive in going after the people's fundamental rights under the Constitution and abrogating them in the name of this crisis.
Yeah.
And I fear that, you know, there's that old saying that only Nixon could have opened the door to China. Well, maybe only Trump could open the door to socialism. You know, because he's doing Bernie Sanders' job for him by the draconian steps that are being taken. And think about this business about the economic recovery.
We're losing your signal there.
We're going to have to call him right back because he's just coming out like there's snow on the lines. Maybe it's his relatives that are mad he's talking about these things.
Could be. I think the battery's going dead.
No, there's something funky going on.
Let's take a break and then we'll see if we can reboot.
Okay. See if Ashley has our little break song tied up. Here's something nice for Easter.
Now let Satan have one more. What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to the plate, took a stand upon God's promise, and stormed hell's rusty gates? What if his people prayed? We prayed for those raised up to lead the way, then maybe kids in school could play and unborn children see light of day. What if the light that we pursue came from a hunger for the truth? What if the family turned to Jesus, stopped asking Oprah what to do? What if his people
is the one thing you should always find? You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Would that we could make that our national song. I love that song. Okay, so now we've got you back out of the snowy sound situation there, Dr. Pry. We've got like 20 uninterrupted minutes to go, huh? How great is that?
Okay, wonderful. To just complete the thought before the National Security Agency started interfering with our conversation.
Yes. Even on Easter, they're working.
Right. I had mentioned, the old saying about only Nixon could have opened the door to China. Well, maybe there's going to be a new saying that only Trump could have opened the door to socialism because of the really unprecedented overreach by government, compromising the constitutional rights of many Americans now in the name of the coronavirus, the appearance of a nanny state, essentially under President Trump, and apparently sanctioned by him. There was a young woman, I think she was on Tucker Carlson, a lawyer, maybe it was Fox News, a lawyer from the Trump administration, attractive young woman who described herself as an evangelical, and at first she was saying all the good, right things, but then she concluded her remarks by saying, and the faith community, people of faith, who exercise civil disobedience and disobey the laws about going to church, you're not going to be doing anything to support religious freedom by doing that. And she discouraged them from doing that.
That's confusing.
Wow.
For a person from the Trump administration to say something like that. But on top of that, what about this business about the so-called V-curve for the economic recovery? I mean, suddenly President Trump sounds like he's a socialist or Keynesian. To believe, to have such faith that by throwing money, trillions of dollars, at our economy, that he's going to be able to work the miracle of an economic recovery from this disaster. Now, conservatives know that, President Trump understood, the chief job, if you want economic prosperity, the chief job of a president is to get government out of the way by lowering taxes, by getting regulations out of the way, by making for a friendly environment to unleash the animal spirits of the free market so that the economy grows on its own. And this is not a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do politically, but intellectually it's not a hard thing to understand. And it works every time. It worked for JFK, it worked for Ronald Reagan, it worked for President Trump. But what never works is the belief that you can throw trillions of dollars at the economy. This is the Democrat and the socialist fantasy. It's magical thinking, I hope it's right. I hope he works this miracle and that after all the damage that's been done. But if you just think about it, when you think about how hard it is, the discouragement of so many small businesses, where are they going to get these grants? How easy is it going to be to get a government grant to keep your, and they're not even grants, they're loans that have to be paid back. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, part of it is
is going to bring back, my measure
banks.
For the success of this is going to be whether the barber shop that I go to down in Mineral, Virginia survives after this. They're closed all through this thing.
Oh, right.
Are they going to come back? Probably not. And so enormous damage is going to be done to the economy. And I don't know who has convinced the president, or maybe he's convinced himself. But this is perhaps we've all known that he's a pragmatic president and not an ideological one. All right. But maybe this is his Achilles heel in not understanding the ideology of the free market, okay? The ideology of what a conservative market economy looks like, the principles that are supposed to be followed. There's reasons for that, because we know that government recovery doesn't work. So anyway, this is my long-winded answer to your question about what do I think about the prospects of getting another 4 years of President Trump. And even if we get another 4 years of President Trump, I don't want this President Trump, right? We're not going to have any alternative, of course. I think he will be reelected. I'm going to be voting for him because there isn't any alternative. I would also add, though, however, that before this event happened, I would have said that President Trump is unbeatable and that he was going to be a shoo-in to be elected. But now he has created a situation where Americans, when they ask the question, are you better off now than you were under the previous administration, They are going to be able to say, no, I'm not.
And look at how quickly that changed. Because, you know, 3 months ago, the answer was yes.
Right.
Well, let's face it, the ace up his sleeve is that Joe Biden keeps you know, talking in his basement and putting out videos that make no sense. And anybody who's watching that has got to be kind of rethinking it. But
and the coronavirus favors the Democrats even there because it keeps Joe Biden from embarrassing himself on national TV.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, it's...
But I hope, of course, I do hope that President Trump gets another 4 years. I think it likely that he will, but I pray to God that he gets a wake-up call from all this and that he learns to govern and stops trusting the deep state to the extent that he has. It's long overdue for him to deliver on his promise about draining the swamp. It's a big swamp that needs to be drained. It's not just a handful of people who surround him. I thought he would have learned that from the... from the impeachment attempt that came out of his own National Security Council staff, you know?
Well, I've always said that if he gets reelected, his next 4 years will be totally different because he has nothing to lose at this point. I mean, if he gets reelected, he can clean as much of that out as he wants and not worry about being reelected. So I'm hoping that...
Yeah, it's great he didn't come from government, but that's also the thing that has made it the most difficult, because I just don't think he realized how evil it is.
Yes, right.
He needed a tour guide like you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he was completely taken by surprise at the depth, and as I have been, I have been surprised by the coronavirus thing. But we don't have much time left. I think we've got another 15 minutes left or something. And on this Easter holiday, the day of the resurrection of Christ, you know, maybe I'd like to drastically shift gears here and talk a little bit about Christianity and the Easter holiday, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. As a historian and perhaps a bit of a mystic, I believe in the supernatural, of course. I believe in God. I shouldn't say of course, because in this stage of secular humanism, vast numbers of Americans don't believe in God and don't believe in the supernatural. But for people who like data, here's some facts for them to chew upon. You know, about the magic of April 11th, the date of April 11th, which is the day before the resurrection of Christ, all right? And in 421 B.C., on April 11th, the Peloponnesian War, there was a peace in the Peloponnesian War. That was the war, by the way, that was sort of the founding war of Western civilization between Greece and Sparta, really between the Delian League, which comprised the democratic states, versus the Lacedaemonian League, the Spartan League, which comprised the tyrannies and the oligarchies of the ancient world. And there was a peace that occurred on April 11th, the day, now that was 421 years before the birth of Christ, you know, almost half a millennium before the birth of Christ, but on April 11th there was the Peace of Nicaea in that war. And in 1713, there was the Peace of Utrecht that ended the War of Spanish Succession, which was a big bloody war. We've forgotten about it now. On April 11th, the day before the resurrection, Napoleon abdicated, ending the long Napoleonic Wars, which was the largest war known to mankind up until that point. Of course, Napoleon escaped from Elba, and there was a brief resurrection of that war that ended at Waterloo, but the big war, the long war, was ended in 1814 with Napoleon's abdication on April 11th. And in 1865, the day before the resurrection, Lincoln called for national reconciliation in the Civil War. Robert E. Lee had surrendered a few days before at Appomattox. The Treaty of Paris ended the Spanish-American War. And in 1961, on this date, Adolf Eichmann was put on trial in Israel. Eichmann was the engineer, Hitler's engineer of the Holocaust. Anyway, it's just a few data points.
Wow.
And maybe that's all coincidence, but I challenge you to find more propitious things that happened at another time in history. You know, I know the historical calendar well, and when you go through most of the days of history, you'll find that mostly it's full of bloodshed, big wars that have happened. But it's an interesting that on April 11th, you have, it's a remarkably peaceful day in historical terms. Now I'd like to talk about this book that I had occasion to read. And I'm not sure I want people to go out and buy it at all, because I love it and I hate it. But it's about Christianity. The history of Christianity is called Dominion: How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. And it's by a guy named Tom Holland. And Holland is a novelist, but he's a good historical novelist. And he does a lot of excellent historical research, and he's written a number of very good novels about the historical, about the ancient world, which I have enjoyed. And this is not a historical novel. It's an actual history. Again, Dominion: How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. I liked 90 to 95% of it, because it's impossible to write a book about the history of Christianity which is not interesting. You know, it is foundational to Western civilization, and anybody with any political perspective that's a little objective can't fail to write a good book if it's about Christianity and the founding of Western civilization. And one of the things that Holland gets right, though, more so than most historians do, and maybe it's because he's a novelist and he has that powerful imagination, but he explains well, I think, the and this isn't original to him. I mean, it came before other historians. But here's another book that does it well and explains that Christianity was not just a religious revolution, but a spiritual and psychological revolution. It really remade man. That's a big claim to make. But when you think about the change that happened between the classical world, the Roman, Greek civilization that existed prior to Christ, and the world that came after, it's incontrovertibly a true claim. You know, the psychology, and you can see the truth of this in take the cultural and architectural examples that existed. Let's just take the Colosseum, you know, and what went on there, the idea of gladiatorial contests. You know, the idea that, you know, that people would throng, the average Roman. In fact, all over the Roman world, there were things like the Colosseum, and gladiatorial contests were held, where men would fight to the death, animals would be butchered for the entertainment of the crowds. And if you look at the gods that were worshipped in the pagan world of that time, you know, Jupiter, Venus, Aphrodite, what was the purpose of these gods? They appealed to the basest instincts and some of the worst instincts of man, not the best. You know, Jupiter and Zeus, Jupiter was not a god of mercy or compassion. You know, they were warrior gods. They believed in the triumph of the fittest. They believed in Achilles dragging the body of Hector around the gates of Troy. Weak are to be despised and destroyed and sold into slavery. And that's what they actually did in the warfare of those days. Cities would be conquered, babies would be slaughtered, the weak and the old killed, the young sold into profit. And that was considered normative. And you're a hero if you did that. That made you a good guy. And human beings themselves had the status. Julius Caesar, Caesar Augustus, you know, had the status of being demigods themselves. They claimed divinity and connection to these. And it wasn't a good divinity by our book. Look at Venus Aphrodite. You know, that's not romantic love. The concept of agape was not known to Venus Aphrodite. It's about sensualism and sexuality, which was part of their religious credo, the idea of the notion of maidenly virtue and abstinence was not something known or respected to that civilization. And all of these things changed in the span of a few generations with Christ. And and the rise of Christian virtues. And that's what, and that is one of the things that Tom Holland gets right. And I see I'm running out of time, and I've only got 5 minutes. Boy, I wanted to capture some of the psychology of the ancient world. Do you know by playing a bit of music for you, but we don't have time. A tune, an ancient tune. I don't know if you guys are familiar with, or the audience remembers the tune from Bozo the Clown.
Seems to be a celebratory sort of a non-sequitur thing at this point.
That is used in circuses, usually to introduce clowns, and it indicates you're going to have lighthearted entertainment and all the rest. It's an ancient tune, and the name of that tune is called Enter the Gladiators. But anyway, it gives you a sense of how people regarded that contest. You know, lighthearted, frivolous thing to see people being butchered. Now, what is the bad part? Why am I, you go through 95% of Tom Holland's book, and this is, and I'm seeing this happen often with modern books on Christianity, because the left is part of the culture war against Christianity, actually. When you get to the end of Tom Holland's book, you find out that he's probably not a believer himself. Holland's theme in the book is that Christianity is a revolutionary movement, and that the most important element of the revolution that was Christianity and that is Christianity is that it favors the weak. It turns to the most oppressed members of society, to the most outcast members of society, to the members of society who seem to be most victimized, and seeks to elevate them. And that this is true throughout history, according to Holland. And that when we get to our own times, those people who support President Trump and who are Christian evangelicals and have conservative values are actually not the inheritors of Christianity, which is a revolutionary movement. They were not the best representatives of the Christian spirit, but the best representatives of the Christian spirit are Marxists and the gay community and the people who play gender politics, even though they're atheists and they reject Christianity and they reject God, because they themselves, even though they would not buy and read Tom Holland's book, they nonetheless are the purest inheritors of the Christian spirit, because they believe in this revolutionary principle of putting the bottom rail on top, of taking the side of the most oppressed and outcast members of society and empowering them. And that's why I hate the book, because I think his interpretation of the lessons of Christianity and what Christianity is all about is untrue. And what I think the book is about it's an attempt to convert to the left Christian fence-sitters, you know, people who aren't quite sure how to make up their minds between the right and the left, and Tom Holland is trying to push them over to the left in terms of and against Trump, against traditional American values, that the Christian thing to do is to support the left, even though the left doesn't believe in God and is basically atheistic. There is, in defense of Holland a little bit, he does ask the question, well, if we kill God and take God out as a factor of history, can the movement of the left survive as a humane force in history and not become totalitarian and become like the Nazis and the communists?
I think the
answer to that question is no, resoundingly, but he is too stupid to see it. And that's why I hate the book, because in the end, he's...
Giveth and he's, taketh away.
Right. And one of the things that makes me hate it most is in the end closing chapters, he talks about how his godmother, who was very important in his life...
We're going to have to go .. on that, because we're going to get cut off.
Well,
like
I should end it there.
8 seconds. But,
okay, well, thank you for having me.
Yes, we will chat with you.
To everybody.
We will chat with you again. You can find everything about the show at WeThePeopleRadio.us.